Welcome to the Afflicted and Affected. My name is Chris Schroeder, and it is the purpose of this webcast to host prominent guests from the fields of addictive illness treatment and other personalities involved in recovery processes. It will be our goal to educate both the professional and non-professional on the most modern and effective treatment methods and resources that are available for them. Our guest today is Mark Houston from the Mark Houston Recovery Center. Mark, how are you doing today?
I am doing great, Chris. It's a beautiful day in Austin, Texas.
Right, you're down in Texas, and I bet it's hot down there.
Yeah, today is a 95 degree with high humidity, but this time of the year, that's real normal.
Mark, how long have you been involved in addictive illness treatment?
Well, I began my own journey with that in the latter part of 1982, and then I actually went to work in this field in 1991, so I guess I've been in it about 16, 17 years.
Okay, and you worked at a number of places before you started your own center.
I've worked in first 6 months at a psychiatric hospital down in Baywood, Texas, outside of Houston, and then 9 years at a 30-day model, and then 6 years at a long-term model, meaning 6 to 12 months.
Sure. Now, what prompted you to start your own recovery center?
It was a combination of a lot of things. My own personal experience with the 12 steps and working with men over the years, and then looking at the places I'd work, looking at current models, looking at things I thought worked, things maybe that I thought didn't work. And it was a very good perspective because, you know, a lot of the chemical dependency or substance abuse market, if you will, is a lot of that's heavily driven by a 30-day model, which has been around for, I don't know, 50, 60 years, and then the long-term model and
the Minnesota model
along the way. And the end result of that was finally in June of 2006, I, through a series of events, finally opened up the Mark Houston Recovery Center out a little bit outside of Austin, Texas.
Okay, now you are called a recovery center, not a treatment center. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I will. There were several things I saw over the years that I thought to myself, someday if I get to do my own thing, there's some things I'm going to really do different. And then there were several things. One of the things is the idea of doing a co-ed, having males and females at a facility who were freshly off of problems, say, with alcohol or drugs, I felt was not conducive to really getting a lot of work done. There was too many distractions. So, and the truth is, even today, there's very few gender-specific programs in the entire United States. So I always felt that there could be a lot more work done if it was males only and or, say, females only. So that was a piece of it. I saw over the years what I think is the true nature of what a 30-day program does, which is will separate people from alcohol and drugs and introduce them to a few things. But it's really the first very, very small step in a lifelong process of recovery. And for a lot of people, it's not anywhere near long enough in terms of the physiological implications of the body healing, a change in belief systems, how you perceive the world. So I looked at that, which is why I really chose a minimum 90-day model. And I think the third most important thing that ties into your question was a lot of states that have licensing now, the states have gotten very, very involved in dictating what you present as, say, information to your clients. And when I looked at what I wanted to do with these men, the things that they dictate that they want you to do were not the things I felt would be helpful to the type of a resident that I was going to have. A lot of my residents have some fairly extensive or some relapse history, and so they've already been exposed to the educational model, in some respects the clinical model, and they haven't been able to stay clean and sober. So I opted to be a non-licensed, non-clinical recovery center. We don't do any clinical work at the Mark Houston Recovery Center. Majority of those men have done an extensive amount of that, and it certainly can be beneficial. They need the tools to begin the path of permanent sobriety, and so that's why I use the term recovery center, because we don't do treatment and we don't do clinical. There's a lot of fine places out there that offer all that, but I felt it was time to introduce something really different. As far as I know, there's not another model like mine in the United States, and that was a recovery-based, spirituality-based model. And in some respects, Chris, what I did, I thought back to my first year in recovery from alcoholism and drug addiction, and said, what do I wish I'd gotten in that first year? And the 12 steps were a methodology in which I had a very profound experience. So I wished I had gotten some clear directions on that. I wished I'd learned more about nutrition, my physical body, working out. I wished I'd learned a little bit more about goal setting, vision, and intent. I wished I'd learned a little bit more about financial sanity. And last of all, being accountable and responsible. And that's really what basically is the program that I put together, is all of those things. And of course, as you can see, none of that really is about being clinical or treatment. And so we're coming up on 2 years, and we've I think had 220 men come through our place. So I think the time is right for the type of program I'm trying to offer.
No, I would agree with you there. To talk about a few of your topics in turn, I think there's been studies that prove the efficacy of a 90-day or a 3-month deal over the 28-day. I believe a lot of countries in Europe and Scandinavia use that model because it's basically been proven to be more effective. But there's challenges in America to doing that. Isn't there funding challenges?
The answer would be yes. Now, in my particular case, I chose a demographic that I felt would have the resources to go down that road. You know, a lot of the better 30-day programs could cost anywhere between $20,000 and $30,000 for, say, 30 days. My particular cost right now per month is $9,500, so you do the math on that. I'm still under some, actually a lot of those on a monthly basis. But yes, there are challenges to that. Everything from can they take the time off to the financial end of it. Yet, I was fairly clear on this demographic. I knew that there were plenty of men out there around the country, and we've had three residents from out of the country, one from Ireland, for example, who their addiction had reached a place where they were there was financial resources and a degree of willingness to do whatever they had to do to finally really achieve sobriety. So I really came at it from that standpoint of, I knew that if I had the right program, that I could find a market for it, where the 90 to 120 days and the financial resources would be a fit, and that has been the case.
Well, that's great. Now, to talk a little bit about the 12 steps, most treatment centers build themselves as 12-step abstinence-based centers. It really looks like you put a lot of emphasis on the residents in their stay. It basically says here in the first month they'll do steps 1, 2, and 3, begin working on their 4-step. In month 2, they'll experience and work with steps 4 through 9. And in the third month, they'll work 10, 11, and 12. How do you do that that's different than some of the 12-step abstinence-based rehabs and treatment centers that proliferate around America?
Well, most of the, say, the 30-day programs, 9-year history at one, is they only have a very limited amount of time. depending on the state of condition of the client who goes to them, how much detox time. Most of them will give them some 12-step literature, talk primarily about the first three steps, maybe introduce them to the fourth step, and then they gotta leave. And unfortunately, a lot of them don't go get hooked into 12-step groups that are real strong on then finishing off, they say, the rest of the steps. And, of course, the steps, based on my experience, only work if I do them all. And so that was the other reason for the 90 days, a significant difference between me and in almost any other places is all of my residents will work through all 12 steps and have an experience. As you mentioned, the first 3 months, or first month, work the first three steps out of the big book and begin to work on their inventory. And as they move into the fifth month, they finish that. I have them read their fifth step, Chris, at least four times to different people. They'll finish that, do step six, seven, make a list. And then the last month, they're going to be doing writing out their men's letters as though they were making them. In some cases, they will make some of those through the mail. And then every morning, in the evening, they're practicing the 10th and 11th step while they're there, and, of course, the 12th step being of service. So I think that's one thing that really differentiates me. They also, in that third month, will listen to a minimum of four fifth steps and tell their story. So by the time they leave, outside of the fact they're going to be going and making some more amends, they've already had a lot of experience and have experientially gone through all 12 steps and have a clear idea what that looks like.
As far as the fifth step, do you have any experience with anything that damaged anyone that was shared and maybe inappropriately repeated?
No, not at all. I use combinations of volunteers, those kinds of things around the fifth step, and that really all stays between those individuals that they read to and them. So that has never once occurred as a problem to us. That's, again, between them and the person that they're going to read to. And we're not in the least been interested in hearing anything about that.
Okay. In ninth step work, do you prepare them to go out and make amends, or are there basically amends that can be done from the center?
Well,
how does that work?
Yeah, we do both. I'll give you an example. Let's say a man finishes up, and let's say he's got 50 amends, 10 are financial, the remainder are, say, employers, family, etc. We literally have them write a letter as though they're making the amends, and that would be, say, to all 50. So that's going to be 50 letters. They're going to talk about what they saw as the nature of the harm. And, you know, we're going to ask the all-important question, of course, what can I do to balance the books between us? In some cases, while they're there, some of the amends can be made via letter. The other thing we do, Chris, I actually have them role-play amends because that's an area that a lot of people, I think, make it to be a lot bigger thing than what it really is.
Yeah, there's trepidation.
Yeah, they have a lot of fear. And so one of the things we do, we literally have them role-play, which is, okay, I'm your father. You're going to sit across me and make the amends, and we give them some of the words out of the big book to use so they have some degree of comfort with that. So in most cases, there will be a few amends made while they're there, and then when they leave, they have a complete stack and letters and cards of all the amends that they have to move forward and make.
That's a very intense approach to the steps. It's certainly not what I would consider normal for treatment centers. You see that it gets results?
Absolutely. You know, we deal with a population. We did outcome surveys are always a little
tricky. Right?
Well, they're a little tricky, but I'll just share with you. You know what we've looked at. We're still new enough. 23 months open. The other day, our first two residents came back and visited us. At least 35% of the guys who go through my place stay in the Austin, Texas area. So, you know, I have what I think are some pretty realistic numbers in terms of, and I'm looking for really one thing, Chris, are they sober, clean and sober? And the last time we looked at that, we do that as a result of face-to-face because we know they're in the area, and or calls to them and or their family. I probably pay a little more attention to how their family reports.
I would guess, right.
What my numbers show based on about 175 discharges is 72% of the men at this point, as far as we can tell, are still clean and sober since he left my place. When we make the call, if we can no longer locate them at all, we just assume the worst, that they're, you know, there's probably a problem there. So, you know, quite frankly, even if it was 50%, I would be well pleased when I look at overall this incredible disease and a lot of the numbers out there. So I think we're on the right path to, you know, to creating more guys being able to leave and really be long-term sober. I mean, for me, it was pretty amazing having my first two residents sit across from me and looking at them. And one's a young man. He's become a he's out in Arizona now. He's studying to become a Harley-Davidson, work on those. I didn't even recognize him. He put on about 40 pounds, and he's working out, and he loves his life, and he's going to meetings, and, you know. Then the other gentleman, he had a long history, 19 years in the penitentiary, and, I mean, at times he lived on the street, and he's living in an apartment. He's got a full-time job. He's sponsoring four men. He came down just to thank us. He's in his late 50s. So that's all the proof I need that, at least we're on to something.
Life skills. You talked about offering mentorship and life skills there. Tell us a little bit about what that looks like.
Yeah, that to me was a real, real important piece. And I'm going to give you an example. I'm going to go through my daily schedule. And one of the things that I've seen over the years, one of the ways I built higher self-esteem within myself is I became responsible and accountable. That's a life skill, meaning if I have a job, I get up in time, sufficient time to prepare myself for the day, and I actually show up to work early, and I work all day. I give my employer a fair day's labor for a fair day's wage. I show up to meetings on time. I manage my time, and so a lot of what I did with my schedule, Monday through Friday, was designed to model what I would call real life. The guys get up at 6. They'll do prayer and meditation 7:30, 7:45 to 8:45. They do work ethic. 9:45, they'll shower, clean up. All of our, I don't even use the term groups, and I'll talk about that a little later. I had to change the language because as soon as I talk to somebody with relapse history and I mention he's going to a group, he forms a perception of what he thinks is going to happen there. We use the term talks. So they get to experience 3 talks a day. They have to be there 5 minutes early. Not 4 minutes, but 5. Teaching them accountability and responsibility. Our talks are never any longer than 45 minutes because a lot of them can't retain much more. They're also very interactive. With a lot of these men over the years, I don't really agree with the lecture. These guys are thirsty for interaction, and so we do one of those from 10 to 10:45. We do another from 11 to 11:45, then 12 to 1, they eat their lunch, and every other week between 12 and 1, we let them observe silence during the lunchtime so they can kind of meet themselves, and then we do another talk from 1:30 to 2:15, and then every day, 3 to 5, they work out. I have personal trainers come out. Then they prepare the. But everything is, so back to the life skill, everything is done on a schedule, much like you and I have to work with on a Monday through Friday. And in there is the disciplines of the 10th and 11th step. In there is a meeting. In there is nutritional food, those kinds of things. So that's one aspect. We also, most of these guys come to us, they've never once did anything at all with goal setting, vision or intent. So we talk to them a lot about that, and we talk to them about, you know, they can be involved with creating that, and what does that look like. That's another life skill thing that we do. We do another thing. This is about, you know, if you go to work for a company in each room we have a room captain, and we have a certain way, certain responsibilities they have. If we go into a room and let's say it's not in order, we don't go to the individual whose area, let's say, is messy or maybe hasn't done his laundry on time or whatever. We go to the room captain. So he gets to learn the skill of interacting with somebody, redirecting them. We also, I don't do a lot of this, but I do three different talks on what I call financial sanity. That's a very critical life skill. So in there, they're introduced to, we have about a 15-page booklet that a financial planner put together for us. We introduce them to what financial sanity looks like. We talk to them about how critically important it is, simplistic things of, you know, setting up a budget. Do a little work with them on interviewing, resume writing. So then, of course, the working out. But a lot at the heart and soul of all of it, Chris, around the life skill issue is the be accountable, be responsible, realize that you create your life.
I think that's really key because, you know, inherent in the in addictive illness is usually life skills have degraded in a big way. People have become irresponsible. People have begun to isolate. You know, character defects are rampant. So something like that. Are you able in 3 months to be able to set someone on a path strong enough for them to be successful in life when they get out?
We're seeing that. You know, the one thing I see with this particular population, again, it's pretty heavy with relapse history. The longer what I call the continuum of care, I believe the higher the results, and that could be 3 to 4 months at my place and then step down to like a transitional sober living, 3 months there, and then step down to a halfway house and then step down to an apartment. And or some cases, of course, if they're going back to a wife and a family, is the area that they're going back to, getting them hooked in with some strong support. So we're seeing the difference it makes in these guys. I pay a tremendous amount of attention in their last month and their preparation for leaving. When they leave, there's a verbiage we use, continuing care plan, but my continuing care plan is all about really recovery, and in there is budget, finances, what are you going to look at from a standpoint of work, and some of these guys, making them understand for maybe first year or so, probably needs to be a little bit simpler job, those kinds of things. But yes, I'm seeing the impact all of this has, also the nutrition and the working out. If you come to my place, I have two gyms, not one, and I have two personal trainers that come out Monday through Friday from 3 to 5, and these are not small gyms. They're 1,000-square-foot gyms. I invested $30,000 in weights, and they do intense workouts, and I watch the tremendous healing that goes on. Some guys come in, they're overweight, some are underweight, they haven't been eating properly, and watching these guys over a month and then two and then three, seeing the change in them as a result of working out 5 days a week, how much better they feel about themselves, how their look changes. Really the integration, Chris, of everything, the body. You know, over the years I'd watch people get sober and completely ignore their body, completely ignore nutrition during the course of a day, not realizing the great impact that can have on mood, how they view life. So that also, to me, is a critically important life skill. Water, not even just being able to drink enough water in the course of a day, because they don't even have an awareness their body's thirsty.
That's amazing. Spiritual laws, Mark.
There's 12 spiritual laws that we work with the men about, what that's about is, you know, you and I operate in this world of relativity, and as far as I can tell looking at it, there's a set of laws that govern our experience in this field of relativity. Example, one of them, cause and effect. If I show up at work late a whole bunch of times, chances are I'm going to lose the job. Not their fault. I violated a basic law of cause and effect, which is what I put out I'm going to get back. We take the different spiritual laws and we make them plug in their own experience. get drunk or loaded, you don't meet them. What do? Well, they get angry with me. They get, okay, so you put that out and it came back to you to make them understand that their troubles are of their own making. What they put out comes back. So there's 12 spiritual laws. We work with them. We work with them on the law of forgiveness. You know, the law of intent, meaning setting a goal, setting an intent for the day, and walking through that. The thing that's important for me in the middle of all that is letting them see by looking at their past experience how they haven't used those laws, that in fact they have, all their troubles are of their own making, then what would happen if they really started working with the law in a positive way? For example, even at my place, and I tell them all the time, the way you show up here is the way you're going to show up there in the world. So if a guy is showing up late for the talks, then what he's doing, he's inviting us into his life, and we're going to come. And he's not going to allow
problems. You're going to help him with that, yeah.
Yeah, but see, the other thing I'm teaching, Chris, is I'll never take responsibility for what they set in motion. And it's amazing when they finally get that. It's like, okay, I'm showing up late for talk, so I'm inviting these staff people in. They're going to say things to me. I'm going to get upset, but I set the ball rolling. Gee, if I showed up on time, that would change. And then literally watching, they've never even seen that simple connection that they truly create their own reality, and that could be extremely positive, or it could be negative.
You know, the spiritual spirituality and how vital it is for recovery from addictive illness. In the past, I've had an opportunity to do talks at colleges and places like that where they're basically training people who are going to become counselors in addictive illness. They're going for their CDC or whatever. And what they've asked me to speak on is spiritual recovery, because it's really a misunderstood principle by so many. I think if you haven't experienced the change by practicing some of these spiritual principles, you don't really understand them. How do you go about getting through to the clients at your facility? And you did talk about having them try them and find out the results, but do you get people who are going to balk at this? Are there people that have problems with some of these spiritual principles?
Well, the way it has to start for us is you have to meet them at their level. So when they first come in, if you've got 12 steps, I work with something I call step zero. Step zero is the current reality they've created. There's no job, family is upset, potential loss of family. The list is endless. And I make them take a look at that, their current reality, not old, but their current, what are they up against? And then I ask them to sit with a question. If that's the best you can do, based on all of your knowledge and all of your power, what's going to happen for you unless you begin to develop and experience new power in your life? And, of course, they may be alcoholics and addicts, but they're not dumb. They'll come back to me and say, all right, I get this. Einstein, I think, said this, and I'm probably not going to quote it correctly, but the mind that created not the problem is not the organism you go into for the solution. So if, in fact, I come to Mark Houston Recovery and my life is complete turmoil through my addiction and my behavior, my belief systems, I get them to look at that. And the reason I do that is that gets them very open-minded to the idea of willing to try something different. And then we take a look at this first step about, is your experience that you're powerless over alcohol and drugs in your life so manageable? And really getting them to look at that, particularly what I like to call the bedevilments or unmanageability, this interior condition. And we use some words, restless, irritable, discontent, trouble in personal relationships, can't control emotional nature, prey to misery and depression, all of those kinds of things. And we have him say, is all of this going on? we also quick to point out to them, this goes on in every human being. And at their very best, that's what they're manufacturing. And the idea that a lot of this comes from the fact they think they're separate from everybody and everything, would they like to see that change? And then you're getting agreement to move into the idea of power greater than themselves. That's where we introduce the idea of spirituality, say, versus religion, and the idea of a relationship with a power greater than themselves. It makes no difference to me what name they wish to call that. Do they need power? Becomes the question I have to sit with. And, of course, if they've been awakened in the step zero and the first step, their only response to that is absolutely. So it strips away a lot of this resistance you might have. And then from there, we talk about the idea in the second step of coming, developing their own personal relationship with a power greater than themselves that's both inside and outside. And is it possible this power is be willing to help and transform you in all these areas? That gets them very open-minded. And we don't let them debate a lot with that. I make them look at where you get all your ideas about spirituality or higher power, or, and of course, most of them, it was either how they were raised or whatever. And I like to ask them, to me, it's a litmus question, how'd that work for you? Well, it's not working. Okay, well, let's come up with a new concept. And then from there, moving forward through the steps, if my experience is, Chris, if I get them to have an experience with how powerless they are and their need for power at their very best, that really makes them open to going down a different path and embracing some new ideas. So that's how I introduce that. Then, of course, every morning we do a half-hour prayer meditation, and then every evening we do what I call an evening review from 10 to 10:30, where they all go back to their rooms and they review their day. A lot of that is, there's a phraseology that we work with at my place called you're asleep, dreaming, you're awake. I introduce them the idea that just because your eyes are open does not mean you're awake. You're on autopilot. Wake up to this. They think they're making choices. And then you have them look at their life and you say, what awakened person would act that way? And they go, oh my God, maybe I am asleep. And you start introducing these concepts to them and their eyes get wide and they go, you know what, I'm going to listen to this. These guys might be onto something here. And so this resistance just melts, but it will not melt, Chris, if I don't have that solid first step experience take place.
Now, obviously, this is kind of an unorthodox model. If you went into 20 or 30 treatment centers around the country, you're not going to see them doing it like you do. Did you have to to implement this process? Did you have to train the counselors or the professionals there for a period of time to get them all in line with this?
You used some words, and it's a good time to talk about this. Is I wanted to change the entire paradigm. And so what I did is I don't have clients, I have residents. I don't have counselors, I have mentors or program directors. We don't do groups, we do talks. We're completely experiential driven. You're not going to endure any lectures at my place. We're going to transmit experience. Everything is going to be extremely interactive. Now, back to your question, over the years, I developed some relationships with some men. A lot of them happen to have worked in the field of chemical dependency or substance abuse. They had a lot of experience, well-grounded in 12 steps, and I started with a core group of 9 of them. And we work off one voice, one message. And then as we bring new members onto the team, then we sit and we have a lot of discussions about one voice, one message. And so after a while, I lived on the property the first 5 months because I wanted to develop a culture. So we have a tremendous culture at Mark Houston Recovery. And much like you could take the Marine Corps or any other company, once you have a culture in place, Chris, then new people come in and people leave.
They assimilate, right.
Yeah, exactly. And so we have this incredibly strong culture. When we admit a new man, he's given a buddy for 48 hours, and the first 48 hours, his buddy goes over the code of conduct, and he absolutely goes over the circle and triangle and look at the idea of a threefold illness and three parts of recovery. We just, right from ground zero, they start to assimilate into the process. So now we have a incredible culture in place. Like, you know, right away he learns, okay, these guys are pretty serious about what they do, so no, you won't be showing up late for this talk. And when these assignments are due, they're going to be due on time. And these guys are about being accountable and responsible. So that's how I was able to do that. I started with a core group, and of course it's grown, but I really spend a lot of time with all of my team and a lot of in-house training and working with each other. And here's the other thing we do. A minimum once a month, I have an outside consultant come in for 2 days, and that whole 2 days he does nothing but work with my team. Because I there's another philosophy and experience I have, is I transmit what I have, but I can't transmit what I don't. So I have him work a lot with the team from a standpoint of they'll transmit what they have. So we are continually, Chris, evaluating and being evaluated ourselves in terms of what are we transmitting. Are we being blocked by some of our own stuff, by some of our own defects? And I put tremendous focus there because I believe this is such a tremendous responsibility I've been given to help in suffering in these men and their families. And so that's how this whole thing has evolved. Now we have a culture, whether you're on the staff or a resident, but it started with a core group who I've known for years who have had a lot of the same experiences I've had.
Okay, now you admit people with either an alcohol or a drug problem. Do you need to change up the processes there for someone, say, who's on crack as opposed to someone who's an alcoholic, or does everybody get the same thing?
Well, I think the only where it's different is over the years I've discovered it's pretty important to identify your drug of no choice. A lot of these guys come in and they'll say, my drug of choice is alcohol. And I say, well, choice implies you can choose to drink it or not drink it. If that's true, why are you at my place? And I make them understand it's a drug of no choice. And then what we do, there's different 12-step fellowships depending on your drug of no choice. So we are fortunate enough in the Austin, Texas area, if I have people and they have a heavy drug history, I can get them hooked into Cocaine Anonymous, say, or if it's an alcoholic, Alcoholics Anonymous. So we do work off the idea, whatever your first step is, that's ultimately the direction that we want you to go to be in the fellowship that is a result of your first step experience. The clear-cut, precise, specific instructions are, we use the same for all the men, but what we do is point them toward, let's find out your truth in your first step.
I think that's definitely important. I think it's important also when you get to the 12th step.
Well, I just, over the years, my experiences, I watched addicts sitting in the rooms of AA, and I watched some of them die. And I'm often reminded of the line that it all starts when one sitting across from another has had the same problem and come up with a solution. I've watched that over the years, and I saw the truth and validity in that. So my whole movement is, if, for example, crack cocaine, right now I have 8 of those guys in the city of Austin. A man I've known for years went ahead and started Crack Smokers Anonymous. And every Monday night, guys who have a history with that drug, we take them to that meeting. And watching, listening to them explain, my God, I finally have someone who understands, who is phenomenal. So I do that because of my own experience. I saw how critically important it was from the standpoint of identification. So I want to work in that way with those guys and point them to the fellowship they need to go to.
Now, toss in your pamphlet a little bit about a code of conduct that the residents need to uphold. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Everywhere you and I go, whether it's the home you live in or the neighborhood, they have a code of conduct. If you work for a company, they have a code of conduct. And you, again, it's different language. Some people use the word rules. I like code of conduct. If you just look at the three words, what they are is they're designed to impart to the men while they're staying at the recovery center, which I view as a recovery center / spiritual retreat center. There's a code of conduct and behavior that they're going to adhere to in many areas, everything from what time they get up to showing up 5 minutes ahead of time for the talks, to the meals, to telephone, and I'll talk about that because we have very limited contact in their time with me. That's what the code of conduct is, and one of the reasons why that's very important as a life skill is, you know, if in fact most alcoholics and addicts suffer from self-will run riot, and my experience is they do, then what they say is code of conducts don't apply to me, whether it's driving down the road and the speed limit says 70 and they go 80 because the rules don't apply. We attempt to teach them that the entire world, everywhere you go, every state, every country, every block, your house, your apartment, they have codes of conduct. And one of your problems has been you don't ever want to follow any of those, so look what you're putting out. So that's how the code of conduct is. We started with a page and a half. It's now 5 pages long because they kept adding to it.
They make their own rules by doing something wrong and you recognize it, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we, the first week, the buddy really spends a lot of time on the code of conduct. But see, if you translate this to real life, Chris, it's so many of these guys, they'll go into a job, for example. The job's got an employee manual, and they're clear on how they do things. It might be dress code. It might be other things. And in their arrogance and grandiosity, they say the rules don't apply. And then what they do is they invite themselves to be written up, or a boss says something, and then their feelings get hurt, and then they go drink. And so a lot of these guys, one of their, in addition to the, you know, we view the alcohol and drugs, Chris, as a symptom. It's not the problem. And the problem is a life based on self-will, and the rules don't apply, and the codes of conduct don't apply. And my objective here is to teach them, yes, they do apply. And they will apply till the day you die. And the sooner you can submit to them, the easier your life gets. So the code of conduct is a very important part of what we do.
Now, you obviously have experience in the treatment model and have experience now with the recovery center model. Let's just pretend for a minute that you're in front of 100 treatment professionals that are running treatment centers, and they want to do a better job with it. What would you tell them that they're missing with the treatment model?
Well, I think the easiest way to answer that, I recently had hired a woman for business development, and the field of chemical dependency or substance abuse was new to her, and so I had her really act like a resident for 2 weeks, and at the end of that, I sat down with 32 men, and I said, would you, and these men have been to a lot of 30-day programs, I said, would you please tell her what you feel is different, and I'm just going to read some of this to you.
Sure.
Number one is the fact that we're an all-male facility, no distractions, they can stay focused. Accountability and responsibility. When our residents leave, Chris, I have a 5-page exit survey. It's very in-depth, even down to evaluating every member of the staff, strengths and weaknesses, including me. I want to know what I'm doing right and what I need to tweak or improve on. And they come in really resisting this accountability and responsibility, but when they leave, they said it's one of the most important things you did is you made us fit into your culture, and you wouldn't change for us. They talked about we model real life. We're set up like a Monday through Friday work week. They talked about the staff was behind the vision, safe environment. One thing they mentioned that's critical, much longer length of stay. One of the biggest things for them is that we're experiential, not educational. We are all about experience. experience. Structure, discipline, and consequences was rated as being very important. One of the things over the years with alcoholics and addicts that continues with their addiction is they avoid the consequences, that law of cause and effect. At my place, they never avoid consequences. Anytime they go against, call it code of conduct, there are consequences of some kind, and I'm trying to teach them that's really how life works. Limited communication with the outside keeps the focus. What that's about, first 10 days they have no contact. They get one phone call a week for 10 minutes. No visitation the first 30 days, only 4 hours the second month, 4 hours the third. I need these men to meet themselves, and they view that as a very important thing, is eliminate all the outside distractions. They felt that the nutrition and working out was critical. Smaller communities, no one ever gets left behind. Learning how to have fun in recovery, they felt the buddy system was critical. And then afterwards, when they leave, they felt that we really had their back covered from a standpoint. Some need transitional sober living, those kinds of things. So, you know, I would probably tell these people, you know, the 30-day model, I think, is intended to do a critical piece. Let them stay focused on that, realizing it's only a tiny step in this lifelong process of recovery. Then the movement from there, I certainly would recommend that they probably do a lot more recommendations to their 30-day residents when they leave about a stronger continuum of care, those kinds of things.
I think it's almost malpractice nowadays to not refer to somebody to the 12-step fellowship that they would fit better in.
Yes.
Now,
I know one thing I would say to them is, I think a lot of them are not paying enough attention to what happens at discharge. Very few alcoholics and addicts drink and do drugs while they're in treatment or rehab. It's when they leave. So what I've learned in that whole process is I pay tremendous amount of attention 1 month prior to discharge. Now, if it was a 30-day model, it could be 1 week. But we actually do talks on, what is it going to be like when you're out there? What are you going to run up against? What are you going to do in this situation? You know, movement toward a home group and a sponsor. And we really do some work with them. So the day they drive out the door, they have a clear plan and a clear path of where to go, instead of just discharge and family picks them up and they drive off down the road.
Yeah, follow-up is certainly critical. And I know in many cases, the resources necessary for that follow-up are not made available in certain places. Do you have plans? Now, you have a men's center. Do you have plans in your future about doing something like this for the women?
Yeah, that has come up numerous times. July 1st will be open 2 years, and I'm now at 40 beds, and that has continually come up. My website, I started tracking 4 months ago, and I get about 30 requests a month, and it really says something like this, is, do you know of any program like yours for women? So I'm seeing there's a need out there.
There's a market,
exploring,
sure.
Exploring that option.
When do you think something like that might be feasible for you?
I would say within a year. One of the biggest things about it, you already brought this up, my culture is so different that what really, you know, if you could ever come and visit from the time you walked on my grounds, you know, everything is very zen, it's very orderly, it's that law of order, spiritual law of order, and then there's this culture. And one of the areas I look at that would concern me is how do I communicate that culture, that same kind of a culture in a recovery center for women. But over time, there's been different women I've met who I felt could very much be a part of that. So I'm not ignoring that. That keeps coming up, and it could very well be by the end of the third year, there may be a Mark Houston Recovery Center for Women.
Now, I believe it was on your website. I saw something like the residents are encouraged not to play with the wildlife.
Yes.
What did you mean by that?
Well, we have 70 acres, and so we call this beautiful property almost feels like you're at a retreat center, but this mm-hmm. is Texas. So, you know, at times with the weather, there's been known to see a few snakes or two, and occasionally coyotes, and so that's kind of what that's all about is don't play with the wildlife here.
Don't pick up the snakes, especially
yeah,
if you're
exactly.
brand new.
Stay away from them.
You got to have 90 days to play with the rattlesnakes.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you see this model proliferating in the future? Do you see that because of the challenges to the clinical model, more and more people are going to be open to something like this?
I strongly suspect that will take place. I'm sure there's plenty of people who are watching what we're doing. We don't seem to be going away. And I fully anticipate you're going to see more models that have a similar feel to this. You know, by the way, one last thing I wanted to mention that
sure.
I feel is critical to a lot of what happens is our environment. I wanted a ranch style setting that almost felt like a retreat center because I felt that would be essential in this healing process, and that's one of the things we have there. That I know it's has so much to do with the guys and their level of comfort. I've been doing this a long time, and quite frankly, very seldom do I ever deal with the issue of I don't want to be here, I want to leave, I want to. And I think a lot of it has to do with this environment, with the two gyms and the two pools, and it's just not necessarily that. The houses are very clean and neat and very orderly, and I teach them that this is their home. Needs to look a certain way, and so it has a very tranquil feel to it. I think that's a very, very important component in one of the things that allows us to do the kind of work. But yeah, I strongly suspect there's going to be more models similar to what I'm doing start to open up around the country.
Now, Mark, we've got a few minutes left. Do you want to talk a little bit about the book that you've authored?
Yeah, myself and a pal of mine, Floyd Henderson, we had worked together over with the 12 steps for years, and really through the vehicle of meditation, one day I formulated the idea of a conversation between me and him, and me taking him through the steps, and literally over the course of about 1 month, we wound up writing a 12-step journey of self-transformation. He and I both had a pretty profound experience with the 12 steps, so we went ahead and co-authored that book together, and the book really is about me taking a man through the 12-step process so that he could have an experience. Then the book kind of went cold case for about 4 or 5 more years, and when I look back, we both felt we needed to do some more writing in 2004. So we really finished the second half of the book, which is about, you know, attaining a spiritual sobriety, mental sobriety, emotional sobriety, and physical. And so then the second half of the book came into being, and it was all experientially driven. So we were able to get that published in 2004.
That sounds good. I have read the book. I liked it very much, by the way. And, you know, I've been following you and your work for over 15 years now. Mark, where do you want to be in 10 years? What do you want to be doing? What do you want to have accomplished in the next 10 years?
My overall objective and mission has always been to end suffering. And I looking at things that have been around 67 years and seeing that we're barely scratching the surface, that I'm not seeing as much what I call permanent sobriety. As I look down the road, I would like to see more Mark Houston recovery centers or something similar around. There's 2 or 3 more books I want to write. I want to continue to carry a strong message of recovery, one that is all experientially driven. In my case, it happened to be through the 12 steps. I see Mark Houston Recovery Center for Women springing up, longer continuums of care, those kinds of things. So those are, when I look 10 years down the road, that's kind of what that all looks like. And having a tremendous amount of fun while I'm doing all this stuff.
It really does sound great. Mark, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Good luck in all your new adventures. Good luck with the Recovery Center. And we'll hopefully we'll have you on again soon.
Great, Chris. Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.